Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
The captain, you know, he went on the radio and he's like, we just want to make sure everyone knows he has a Paralympic champion on the plane.
On the Podium is back with more Olympians and Paralympians sharing their remarkable stories. On the Podium. Listen now, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach at 13 GMT on Wednesday, the 9th of August. These are our main stories. Eyewitnesses say more than 40 migrants have been killed in a shipwreck off the coast of Italy. Nine bodies are found in a burned-out holiday home for adults with learning disabilities in eastern France. Poland increases troop numbers on its border with Belarus as it says more migrants are trying to cross. Also in this podcast...
Because of the 3 years of the pandemic, our incomes are not as stable.
We don't have customers like we did before. People are buying less.
Consumer prices fall in China, tipping the world's second largest economy into deflation. First, eyewitnesses say 41 migrants have drowned off the southern Italian island of Lampedusa after their boat capsized. Survivors say the vessel had set off from Tunisia. Our correspondent in Rome, Sofia Battizzi, reports.
We do know that 41 migrants died and they were killed in a shipwreck off the coast of Italy's island of Lampedusa, which is in the south of the country in Sicily. Now, this is all being reported by Italian media and by the news agency ANSA, and they have spoken to four people who survived the shipwreck, three men and one woman from the Ivory Coast and from Guinea. So what they said is that they were on a boat that had set off from Tunisia on Thursday. They were trying to reach Italy. They described it as a very small metal boat, about 7 meters long. They said that 45 people were on board, and that includes three children. Now, they said that only they were at sea for about 6 hours, which is not very long. They were sailing in the Sicilian Channel, and that's when the boat capsized and sank. Apparently, the boat capsized because of a very big wave that threw everybody who was on board into the water. Now, the survivors said that out of the 45 people who were on that boat, only 15 of them were wearing life vests. They were left in the water at sea for several hours before they were rescued by a cargo ship and brought to the island of Lampedusa today.
Sofia Battizzi in Rome. Nine people are known to have died following a fire at a holiday home hosting people with learning disabilities in eastern France. The authorities say two people are still missing but are also presumed to have died. This from our Europe regional editor Paul Moss.
This was in the town of Vinzenheim, which, as you said, is in eastern France, very close to the border with Germany. What we know is that a fire began there at about 6:30, when predictably most of the people and maybe all of the people there were asleep. It began on the ground floor. We understand people there were evacuated, 17 of them, although one needed very serious hospital treatment, but the people were trapped on the first floor. And it seems that the bodies of nine have already been found, two still missing. We understand that 10 of the people who appear to have died were people who, as you suggested, had learning difficulties. They were there on a holiday, and one of the missing was a supervisor who looked after them. The Interior Minister of France, Gérald Darmanin, has paid tribute to the rapid and courageous intervention by firefighters, but it seems that wasn't enough.
And do the authorities have any understanding yet as to why this fire was so devastating and seemed to spread through the building so rapidly?
Well, I think it's clear when you look at pictures from the scene. This was a building, a holiday home made in the traditional Alsace region style, which means they're very pretty, but they're made of wood. And when you look at it, you can see this charred timbers and this gutted roof, exactly the sort of place where a fire would spread very quickly. We've had word from Philippe Aouillier, who's the commander in charge of the operation. He said they're having trouble still searching the building for those two bodies because there's a huge amount of rubble and, as he said, many collapsed sections. So I think it may be a while before anything could be established for sure about what happened and before those two remaining bodies are found.
Paul Moss reporting. Having been reinstated as an MP after a 2-year sentence for defamation was suspended, the Indian opposition leader Rahul Gandhi has gone on the offensive. He's accusing the Prime Minister Narendra Modi of murdering Mother India through how he's responded to armed clashes in Manipur. A little of the reaction there. Chants in the parliament of Modi, Modi, to what Mr. Gandhi had to say. Our correspondent in Delhi, Raghvendra Rao, is following the story.
It was a no-holds-barred attack from Rahul Gandhi on Prime Minister Narendra Modi as he took part in this debate on the no-confidence motion which the opposition parties have brought against Mr. Modi's government. Now, Manipur is one issue on which the opposition parties, they have been criticizing Prime Minister Modi for having maintained a complete silence. But for the occasion when he spoke briefly after, a video went viral showing atrocities against a couple of women. Now, as he took center stage today in the parliament, Rahul Gandhi accused Prime Minister Narendra Modi of murdering Mother India in the violence hit state of Manipur. He said, pointing towards the BJP legislators, he said that they killed India in Manipur, their politics killed India in Manipur, and he basically doubled down on that, saying that Prime Minister Modi did not go to Manipur because for him, Manipur is not a part of India. So all of these statements which Rahul Gandhi gave, they drew sharp responses from the Treasury benches. There was a lot of uproar in the House. People from the Treasury benches were trying to rebut and contradict what Mr. Gandhi was saying. So a lot of acrimony in the House till the time Mr. Gandhi was speaking there.
Lots of sound and fury, but in the end, does the Prime Minister Narendra Modi have control, have authority in the House? He still does.
Well, absolutely, because BJP, remember, has a very commanding majority in the House in a legislature of 545 members. The halfway mark is 272, and the BJP on its own has more than 300 legislators there. And if you add their allies to them, the number goes up to around 330. So the fate of this no confidence motion is already a foregone conclusion. The BJP is going to sail through this rather smoothly. But, for the opposition parties, this no confidence motion is very, very significant and important because through this no confidence vote, they think that, they will finally be able to force Mr. Modi to talk about Manipur, something which he has, shied from doing so far.
Raghvendra Rao with me from Delhi. The end of the 3-year COVID crisis in China was expected to see its huge economy bouncing back strongly as restrictions were lifted on people's movements and on business activity. The response from Asia's economic giant, though, has been sluggish at best. Figures today show consumer prices fell by 0.3% in July compared with the previous year, the first deflation since early 2021. And there are fears that poor consumer and business confidence could send China into a long period of falling prices and stagnant growth. This from Stephen McDonnell in Beijing.
The next station is Guangzhou.
The bustling scene on Beijing's vast underground train network is exactly what you'd expect for a modern city of more than 20 million people. At times during the COVID crisis, it was strangely quiet though, with many working from home or choosing to stay indoors. But these days, it's as if COVID never happened. At face value, this would seem to show an economy rebounding strongly. Well, analysts are telling us that's not actually the case. The crowded walkways leading from stations to shopping centres belie the fact that consumer spending, especially on big-ticket items, has been quite weak here. People are nervous about job security or about the value of their homes, so they're saving more.
Because of the 3 years of the pandemic, most people don't have as much money to spare to even buy certain foods, drinks and clothes. They are just more cautious than before. Our incomes are not as stable.
A woman running a shop selling pretty cheap pastries says she too is feeling the pressure.
We don't have customers like we did before. People are buying less. We all know what the economy is like now. Everyone is spending money on what's important.
Less spending and less confidence is pushing down prices on many products. In one way, that may sound good, but there are fears the country could be heading into a period of deflation with stalled business investment. Harry Murphy-Cruz is an economist at Moody's Analytics, specialising in China.
If you're a household, you're thinking of buying a couch, well, if you think prices are going to keep falling, then you've got no incentive to buy it this month, but rather hold off to next month. But because you've held off, that's pinching retailers, they start to cut their prices already, and you sort of entrench this cycle that's incredibly difficult to break.
On the outskirts of every major Chinese city, there are forests of tower blocks with flats that nobody wants. Real estate oversupply has driven down the value of family homes, hitting the biggest investment of ordinary people. The government doesn't want to make the situation worse, so it's been loath to pump more money into propping up developers. But it needs a solution. Again, Harry Murphy-Cruz.
There's certainly more stimulus that's going to be needed to actually kickstart the economy. And realistically, one of the key challenges for Chinese households is that property sector. So while that's still struggling, household spending is going to really crawl.
Home renovation support, tourism stimulus, and means to encourage more electric car sales are all on the table. Ultimately, though, it might just be a matter of waiting. If the global economy picks up next year, this will drive international demand for the stuff China makes. A shot in the arm for production here would then feed back into global growth. So maybe China's policymakers will just try to ride out the next 6 months in the hope of better times ahead.
Steve McDonnell in Beijing. The latest in a series of typhoons that have been battering parts of Asia is slowly edging past Japan. The storm has winds of up to 144 kilometres an hour and is expected to bring record rainfall, mudslides and floods to Japan and then South Korea, which is expected to hit on Thursday. Our Asia Pacific regional editor is Jason Lee.
It's killed at least two people last week in the southern Okinawa Islands in the Pacific Ocean. Right now, thousands of homes are reported to be without power as heavy rain pounded the southern Kyushu island. Because of the storm's relatively slow pace, rain clouds have lingered, resulting in these substantial downpours. Hundreds of flights have also been cancelled, and Japan's Shinkansen bullet trains, which are famous for their fast speed, have been halted in the southern areas. Now, the storm comes as the city of Nagasaki, which is located near the storm's path, marks the 78th anniversary of the atomic bombing of the city, which has now been scaled down and moved inside. The Japanese Prime Minister, Fumio Kishida, also cancelled his attendance at the event because of this storm.
Let's talk about South Korea. There have been all sorts of extreme weather events there. There's been extreme heat, and this typhoon is expected to do quite a lot of damage when it arrives in South Korea.
Yes, so it's expected to make landfall in South Korea on Thursday morning local time, but rains and winds are already growing in southern areas as the storm draws closer to the Korean peninsula. Authorities have issued highest alert and flights have been grounded on the southern Jeju Island, and ships at the country's two biggest ports in Busan and Incheon are being evacuated. Now, it's worth mentioning that South Korea experiences typhoons regularly during its summer season. Last month, at least 47 people died due to torrential rains and floods, and out of those 47, we know that 14 of them died when an underpass was flooded in the city of Cheongju. An inquiry launched after the incident found officials had ignored multiple flood warnings. So, in order to prevent such tragic incident from occurring again, officials are putting extra focus ahead of this typhoon on inspecting vulnerable facilities such as drainage facilities and underground tunnels.
Jason Lee reporting. Now to Texas and a story that's getting a lot of traffic online today. It's about a woman called Peggy who was just doing some gardening when she was attacked by a hawk and a snake at the same time. Here's Terry Egan.
It could be a story out of the Bible or an Aesop's fable, perhaps. Peggy Jones was happily mowing her lawn in a town in Texas near the Louisiana border when something fell out of the sky. A snake, no less. As if that weren't bad enough, a hawk that was circling overhead clearly regarded that snake as its prey and wanted it back.
Out of the sky, out of the clear blue, a snake fell onto my arm, and he wrapped around my arm and just held on tighter. He kept striking in my face. He was striking my glasses, just started praying out, Jesus, help me. Please, Jesus, help me.
Eventually, though, the hawk succeeded in dislodging the snake from Peggy's arm, and her startled husband drove her to hospital. Peggy regards herself as lucky to have survived. There were puncture wounds, cuts, abrasions, scratches, and severe bruising, she said, describing the attack as traumatic, and adding that she thought she was going to die. And just in case you think this is a rare fluke occurrence, Peggy went on to say that living in rural Texas and having already survived a venomous snake bite, she's no stranger to wildlife encounters, but not usually quite like this one.
Terry Egan reporting. Still to come in this podcast, the Russian authorities introduce a new school textbook which includes justifications for the war in Ukraine. And
the image on God Save the Queen by the Sex Pistols, with the Queen's eyes and mouth hidden by the cut-out words of the song's title, is probably the defining image of punk in the 70s.
The man who designed that has died.
Do you ever feel a bit overwhelmed when you check the news on your phone first thing in the morning?
Whenever I open up my phone, there are just endless warnings of more extreme weather to come.
I'm Hannah. I'm the presenter of a new podcast called What in the World from the BBC World Service. We're going to be here trying to help you make sense of the world around you so you can feel a little bit better about what's happening in the world. You can find What in the World wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
The US state of Ohio has rejected a Republican motion to make it harder to change the state's constitution, a move seen as a defeat for anti-abortion groups. Since the US Supreme Court overturned federal abortion protections with Roe v. Wade last year, states have raced to either protect or restrict abortion. Ohio will vote on abortion in November. Had this referendum passed, it would have made it harder for abortion rights to be protected. The Democratic mayor of Columbus, Andrew Ginther, gave his reaction.
People came out and sent a very strong message to an extremist supermajority in the legislature that they believe in fairness, they believe in freedom, and they believe in the power to hold them accountable.
CBS correspondent Jared Hill told me more about the vote.
This on the ballot itself was purely about the threshold right to change the state's constitution, going from instead of 50% plus one vote to 60% vote. And we saw here, as you mentioned, that that got struck down, keeping with that 50% plus one. Now, while the abortion issue was not on the ballot, we do know that Republican lawmakers who supported this change linked these two together as they were advocating and pushing for the adjustment there. So this definitely was, in the end, by and large, about the issue of abortion, at least largely within the state. There were some people that were speaking a bit more broadly about wanting to maintain the ability to vote the way that they've been voting for decades here. But really, this was about abortion.
President Biden is pleased. He's hailing this as a victory for those who want to protect abortion rights. What will the Republican legislature do in response to this, though?
So President Biden is really attaching himself to this one because, again, you do have this 2024 vote coming up for presidency. And some recent CBS News polling has shown that Democrats, by and large, are more motivated to go to the polls around the issue of abortion than are Republicans. Now, when it comes to state Republicans in Ohio and what they do next, they're essentially accepting, right, that this is now the law of the land, that this is the vote. They potentially could bring this up again, maybe not as early as next year. But at this point, they're saying that their focus really is going to be on trying to defeat the ballot initiative in November that would enshrine the right, the protections to abortion in the state constitution. So essentially, at this point, they've moved on from this. They'll take note of any, you know, shortcomings there might have been and really focus on making sure that abortion is not a part of the state constitution in Ohio in that November vote.
And are we going to see processes like this playing out in other states?
Possibly. So we have seen some attempts to get measures like this up for a vote in some other states, though so far have failed. But we do, again, know that ever since the Supreme Court overturned the federal right to an abortion, said there was not a federal right to an abortion in the Constitution, this has really been something that has popped up in a lot of states. And we've seen a lot of states where this has come up since then, rejecting this notion that there should be a ban on abortion, at least when this is given up to the people and not just left up to lawmakers in those states. So again, this is an interesting test, as we're continuing to see, around how Americans on an individual level, once they go into the voting booth, are weighing the right to an abortion, or in some cases, the right to privacy, as many of them might see it.
CBS correspondent Jared Hill. From Ohio to California, and a judge in Los Angeles has given a 10-year prison sentence to Tory Lanez, the man convicted of shooting the Grammy-winning rapper Megan Thee Stallion in the foot during an argument in 2020. It's a case with serious celebrity interest. Lanez is a hip-hop artist. They both made music addressing the issues. The shooting took place after the pair left a party at the home of reality star Kylie Jenner. The district attorney, George Gascon, said it also highlights the trauma experienced by survivors like Megan Thee Stallion, whose real name is Megan Peet.
The fact that Ms. Peet is a successful entertainer has brought a spotlight on the important issue of violence against women. There are many people in our community that endure acts of violence every day from people close to them and feel reluctant to come forward when this happens. I hope that Ms. Peet's bravery gives hope to those that feel helpless.
Our correspondent in Los Angeles, Peter Bowes, told me more about the case.
Tory Lanez was found guilty in December of last year on three counts after the shooting of Megan Thee Stallion. This followed a pool party at Kylie Jenner's home in the Hollywood Hills in 2020. The two of them had apparently had an argument. This is Tory Lanez and Megan about his musical ability. She claims that he then told her to dance, and that's when she ended up being shot in the foot. Now, he maintained his innocence throughout. His lawyer said there'd been a botched investigation. But what we've just had, an unusually long two-day sentencing hearing, long because many people came forward, many letters were sent to the judge, character witnesses speaking up for Tory Lanez in terms of his plea not to be sent to prison for this crime. He also spoke, he said, of Megan. He said, she is someone I still care for dearly to this day, regardless of what she may think of him. He said that he was the victim's friend, and he talked about bonding with her over the loss of their mothers. We didn't hear directly from Megan in that she wasn't in the courtroom. She said she struggled with whether to appear in person, but didn't for the sake of her mental well-being. But in her statement, she said since the shooting, she hadn't experienced a single day of peace and that he had shown no remorse.
Peter Bowes in Los Angeles. Now, can you remember the history you learned at school? School textbooks can be crucial to shaping a whole generation's perception of historical events. In Russia, authorities have unveiled a new school textbook, including justifications for the war in Ukraine and accusing the West of trying to break Russia. BBC Monitoring's Russia editor is Vitaly Shevchenko.
The book presents Russia's history as a centuries-old struggle between Russia and aggressive West. And essentially, it's an example of how history is being weaponized in Russia, because past events, real or imaginary, are being used to justify the current government's policies, such as the war on Ukraine. To give you one quote that I think kind of encapsulates the thrust of what the textbook says about Russia's most recent history. It argues that if President Putin had not started his so-called special military operation against Ukraine, this would have possibly been the end of civilization on planet Earth. And this textbook is full of very obvious manipulations and, untruths. To give you an example, it says that until 2014, when Russia first attacked Ukraine, 80% of residents of Ukraine said the Russian language was their mother tongue. That's untrue. Numerous opinion polls, surveys, and a census in 2001 said that about a third of residents of Ukraine say that Russian is their mother tongue.
It isn't uncommon for history to be told sort of through the prism, through the lens of the nation where children are learning it. It sounds like this goes further than that, though.
It does. This is how I was taught history as well back in the Soviet Union. But this textbook, it feels kind of more relevant and more necessary for the government right now, which is keen to use this textbook to justify its war in Ukraine. This is the first such textbook to mention this war.
Vitaly Shevchenko reporting. Poland is increasing troop numbers on its border with Belarus, as it says it's seeing an increase in migrants trying to cross in recent days. The Polish government has accused Belarus of facilitating the passage of the migrants. From Warsaw, our Eastern Europe correspondent Sarah Rainsford has more.
Poland has been talking about securing its eastern border a lot in recent weeks. First, increasing the number of border guards and now sending an additional 2,000 soldiers in support. That's as well as the giant metal fence that already separates Poland from Belarus and is covered with cameras and motion detectors. It appeared after 2021 when tens of thousands of migrants were encouraged to Belarus and then helped across the EU's eastern border, creating a political and humanitarian crisis here. The Polish government faces re-election in a couple of months and it's been talking tough on both migration and security. It also says it's worried that Russian mercenaries from the Wagner Group, now in Belarus, might somehow start to help the migrants to cross. That seems unlikely. They weren't needed 2 years ago. But both Poland and Lithuania are keeping a close and wary eye on Wagner's movements across the border.
Now, taking health advice can be a struggle. There is good news today from two new reports. One says something as simple as eating nuts can reduce depression in adults. The other says we don't need to walk quite as far as we used to think necessary to improve our physical health. Here's Wendy Urquhart.
For years, thousands of us have been pounding the pavement, trying to reach that magic goal of 10,000 steps a day to stay fit and healthy. But new research has found that walking just half of that could also save lives. Researchers followed 227,000 people for 7 years to complete their study. What they found was that walking at least 2,300 steps a day was really good for the heart and blood vessels, and the more people walked, the more they reduced the risk of dying from cardiovascular disease. And every 1,000 steps above the 4,000 steps mark brings down the risk of dying early by 15%.
Now, the man who crafted the image which came to define punk music, the artist Jamie Reed, has died at the age of 76. Let's look back at his life with our arts correspondent, David Sillitoe.
The image on God Save the Queen by the Sex Pistols, with the Queen's eyes and mouth hidden by the cut-out words of the song's title, is probably the defining image of punk in the 70s. Jamie Reed had met the band's manager Malcolm McLaren at art school in Croydon. His lettering, in the style of a cut-and-paste ransom demand, was key to the Pistols' look. But this was just a small part of his life and work. Deeply political, Jamie Reed created banners, flyers and posters for dozens of protests over the years, taking on the poll tax, English heritage and the Gulf War with a lipstick-wearing John Wayne, a radical to the end whose most notorious royal image is now hanging in the National Portrait Gallery.
Our arts correspondent, David Sillitoe. And that's all from us for now. There will be a new edition of Global News later. If you want to comment on this podcast and the stories we included, drop us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. On Twitter, we are @globalnewspod. This edition was mixed by Chesney Fawkes-Porter. The producer was Stephanie Tillotson. The editor is Karen Martin. My name's Andrew Peach. Thank you for listening. Till next time, goodbye.